The Amelia Island Museum of History's Heritage Keepers Project is interviewing Nola Perez on October 27th, 2020. Interviewers are Dickie Anderson and Patty Boxler. We are in Nola's home on Amelia Island. Nola Perez is a native of Amelia Island and grew up on its beach and in its historic town of Fernandina. She has lived in France, Belgium, Venezuela, Atlanta, and South Miami Beach. She has recently been recognized as Poet Laureate of Fernandina Beach. Among her honors are the 1997 Robert Penn Warren First Poetry Award, finalist in the Anahinga Press Poetry Series, and others. She's been awarded publication grants from the City of Atlanta, Bureau of Cultural Affairs, and the State of Georgia. She has written three memoirs, numerous books, and chapbooks. We will be focusing on her growing up in Fernandina on Amelia Island and how her experiences and reflections of the island have impacted her work. First, Nola, can you share with us your family background, where you were born, parents, siblings, and how you ended up in Fernandina?
Well, I ended up here because my father chose, and why, I don't know why he chose to build a house at Fernandina Beach, but he did. And I lost him when I was 15. I wasn't, you know, into wanting to know things as most teenagers are, you know, they're just having a good time getting through 14, 15. But my father passed away suddenly, away from home on a business trip in a hotel with his driver, a black fellow named Rufus, because he couldn't drive. He had a blood clot in his leg, and he died when it went to his heart. So that's...
So you were born in Jacksonville, and how old were you when your family came to Amelia Island?
My father was married once before, and I don't know anything about that family. I had a half-brother who had his name Walter Nolan Baker Jr., but I just met him briefly. But he was in Jacksonville for some reason, and he met my mother-to-be. She was from Bainbridge, Georgia, and she was working for H&W Drew Company as a secretary. And how they met, I don't know, but they met, they started dating, and my mother had a young son, George Derrick, named after his father. And a funny story George would tell me about their dating. He said, I always made a big fuss and fit, and they had to take me on their dates. So anyway, we got this lovely half-brother. It was never half a brother to us. He was the best big brother on the planet. Wow. So lucky to have him. But so they started dating, and they got married. I wasn't here yet, so I don't know anything about it.
So how did they come to Amelia Island?
Huh?
How did they come to Fernandina?
Well, that is because my father was a manufacturer's agent, and he traveled a lot. So my vague childhood memories of being, after I was born at St. Luke's Hospital in Jacksonville, I vaguely remember being in Atlanta for a short period. I was just a little kid, but I have some memories of that. And after that is when we came to Fernandina. Now, I don't know the exact date, but I do know that my maternal grandmother, Dosha Sheffield, my grandfather had passed away, and my grandmother had the money from his legacy or whatever, and my father told her, if you will buy this little house in Fernandina, then I'll make you private quarters on the back of it, and then, you know, when there's, because this was during the Depression, you know, 30s. So that's what we did. My grandmother bought that house, I think it was 626, that's her Georgia address, It was the corner of Date, at 6 and Date, in a little house at the corner of 6 and Date. And my grandmother bought it. He did build her a nice apartment on the back with a private entrance. So she was an Avon lady, so she could come and go when she wanted. She had a big black umbrella. She'd walk the streets delivering her stuff under that black umbrella, ever thankful for her beautiful skin that never got in the sun. And when she died, her caregiver says, "You wouldn't believe, Nola." She said, "Her skin was like a baby's." I said, "Yeah, well, I should have paid attention." It didn't. I grew up on the beach.
So that was the first house your family lived
that
in?
That was the first house. And in that house was my mother and I, and my baby brother Jim and George and Grandmother Sheffield. And my father traveled a lot. So he was gone a lot. And so what happened is they got a divorce. Before he built the house at the beach, they got a divorce. The reason being, she had an affair, and my father was never a man that would have stood for that. So anyway, he divorced her, and that was in early 1930s. And the court was Jacksonville, and I was told by my brother George, you know, if you ever want to know what happened, all you got to do is go to the courthouse, and said he nailed her to the cross. Well, I know he did, because the judge awarded the children to the father. Imagine that in the 1930s.
Yeah.
And gave her visitation rights, you know? I mean, so anyway, it must have been a bad show, but I said I didn't want to know any of that, you know. Leave that out.
How old were you, Nola?
Well, I was 6, and my baby brother was 4. When she was gone, and when she was gone, she was gone. She married the man she had an affair with, and she was never there for us after that, ever. I actually just not have a mother. I was raised by a black nanny, and I was reading a letter from her that was written to me when I was in Paris, in which she said, "Your mother gave you to me when you were a baby," and she said, "I loved you like that." So my mother was not maternal, and my Aunt Murdy Burgess, who was the wife of Judge Burgess at that time, she said, "Your mother said to me, I don't mind having the baby, that somebody will just take over from there." And she said to me, she was scandalized, she said, "Can you imagine a woman saying that?" And I said, "I guess I could, you know."
Nola, what do you remember about living in that house and what the town was like? Were you able to walk downtown?
Yes, I walked to school. I walked home from school. Now, kumquats off our neighbor's trees.
Was the school the building that is now the administration building?
That was the yellow brick building. That was our school from grade 1 to grade 12.
How many children were in a class?
In a class? Gosh, I don't know. I could look in my yearbook and tell you how. I think 12, 14, something like
that. But that wasn't like the 8th grade. Was it a multiple grade class?
Yes. So we were such family at that time in that school, because everybody knew everybody and everybody's parents, and it was like family, you know.
Were you allowed to walk downtown?
Yes, we were.
What was Center Street like then? What kinds of shops?
Center Street was mostly the way it is now, except for the fancy shops that we have now. But it was more or less the same, you know. And across from the post office, I remember we had Wasson's drugstore there. And that's where the kids love to go and have a cherry coke or whatever, and a lot of different stores and people who knew people. And I'm trying to think of the store down near the river, Jeans, which was an everything store. And you go in there and there was just anything you would want. I mean, there were kind of these family operated and owned stores, you know, and they no big.
What was the river like then? What was the port like?
The port was much the same as it is, except we didn't have, of course, the restaurants and the buildings. We had the fishing vessel buildings, and you know that my father would go there and buy. It came in these golden colored cans, buy a fresh seafood, and but the river was not. I mean, it was not the congregation place that it is now. It was just that the river was at one end and the ocean was at the other, and that was, well, that's what we loved. You know?
Now, how long would it take you to walk from your house on the beach to school?
Oh, from the beach? I rode the bus from the beach.
Okay.
But I walked from my grandmother's house.
So you were living at your grandmother's house for elementary school?
Well, yes.
Tell us about the house that your father built. I know you have wonderful memories.
On the beach?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, he built a gorgeous house of his own design and supervised the whole thing. Upstairs was our living space, wonderful, with wall-to-wall windows so that all the ocean could come in. We didn't have air conditioning, so the windows were up and the ocean roared in. And I remember hearing that going to bed at night, you know, lonely. And downstairs was a double garage, and there was an apartment on the left side and an apartment on the right side that he rented out. And then he also built that house, White House, across the street that is no longer there. They tore it down for something or other. But he built for to bring in money.
Nola, what was the address?
I knew you were going to ask me.
Fletcher.
Huh? Fletcher Avenue. South Fletcher. I'll have to get the address for you because, you know, that's one of the things that goes.
But it had a different name, didn't it? The 1846?
No, it became a bed and breakfast after my father died.
And what was that called?
The 1846? The woman, I asked her about the date, and she said it was significant, but it was 1875 house or something like that. I can give you the exact name.
Now, was that fountain in the front there?
No. Pas de tout. We had sand dunes around us.
Okay. How many houses were around you, and were there other children, and what kinds of activities did you have?
We had the beach and inner tubes, and we were turned out. And no adult ever watched us or worried about us being in the ocean. You know, nobody came and took care of us. We just went out and had our fill of the beach and the front yard swimming pool. And it was wonderful.
Next to my father's
house was the log cabin, which that also became a restaurant. And then there was a little board house on the other side that one of the hurricanes took, but didn't take our house. It took their house. So,
what do you know any stories about the log cabin house?
I don't, except that I had many lovely dinners there, and I liked the people. They were their name was Hogg, H-O-G-G. I remember that because their daughter went to school with us. I can't remember her first name, but. I remember they were the Hogs.
What are your memories of Main Beach? What at the end of Atlantic, at the ocean, what was there?
We had, at that time, we had the
pavilion
on one side that was a restaurant downstairs and places where you could go and change your clothes, long boardwalk. And upstairs was a skating, you could go skating and bowling, and that was our main entertainment place, and it was so sad when it was gone.
Was that hurricane or
I don't know.
Did it just?
I was away when it went down, and I assume it was just in the name of progress, you know. Like taking the Keystone Hotel, progress, awful, awful.
Was there transportation between Fletcher and your house to get to downtown?
No, there was not.
You said something about a bus.
I took a bus to school.
Was it a school bus?
School bus.
Not
that
public
was our
transportation.
Early transportation, unless my father took me. But I walked from my house to Main Beach many times because Moore's was there. Moore's Bar, and they also had a grocery store, but they had an enormous dance floor with windows open to the ocean. And on Labor Day, they would have a live orchestra, and that was a big event of summer. It was Labor Day dance at Moore's, and it was fabulous, just plain fabulous. And they never monitored or worried about kids, young people having liquor. I guess they just didn't serve it to them, you know. But that was our hangout.
There is a great tradition in Fernandina Beach, what used to be Fernandina, of parades. Do you remember parades when you were growing up?
I remember one significant parade downtown. My father came home one time. He had the back taken out of his car, and he brought home a Shetland pony named Bill. And if you ask some of my cohorts my age around here, they remember that. Remember Mr. Baker bringing home a Shetland pony. And so my father bought a little cart, and it was a 4th of July parade. And my brother Jimmy and I were in the parade in that cart behind Bill, our Shetland pony, which I was terrified of. They made me ride him on the beach, and he would go up in the sand hills, you know, to eat foliage, and I couldn't get off, and I had to, one time somebody had to come and get me off. I was scared to death of him.
Didn't you, I thought you shared a memory of seeing the Ku Klux Klan march in a parade.
Down the middle of Main Street, yeah, unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. But you know what, in terms
of... How many men were dressed in Ku Klux Klan's?
Oh, almost all of them.
Well, ten or 20?
Oh, more than that. You know, dozens.
Dozens.
I was going to say something about that.
Did that upset you or upset your family?
Well, I don't recall we ever talked about it. You know, when I grew up in Fernandina, there was discrimination against the blacks. You know, that the Island Theater where we went to the movies, blacks had to sit upstairs and the white people sat downstairs. Well, and then they had their black high school and we had our white. But you know what? I was never tainted by that because I was raised by a black nanny whom I loved, and my father had a black chauffeur who would take us kids riding down the Fort Road in the back of my mom's a wooden-sided station wagon and let us hang our feet off the back. At that time, the road was free to go to the fort. You know, you just went to the fort. It wasn't...
Didn't your father have quite a collection of cars, automobiles?
Well, he had... All of his cars were Lincoln Zephyrs, but I don't know about the color. But they were all, and he was very proudly, I have a picture in there of him beside one of his cars from the dealer that was in the newspaper, you know, Mr. Baker's signature car.
Now, you just mentioned Fort Clinch and that the road was free to go there. How often did you go to the fort?
Anytime we wanted, and we rode our bicycles from home down that road to the fort or up on the sand hills, which we were allowed to climb. Nobody said a word about, you know, erosion. We walk all over the sand hills on the top and have a picnic there. And
was it open as a state park then?
No.
Was it manned by anybody watching it, or was it just a relic sitting
there?
We
just were able to walk in. So as far as I know, it was not a state, you know, a designated thing then. And I have a picture of my friend Iris and me having a picnic on one of the parapets facing the ocean. You know, we just were free to climb all that thing and go anywhere we wanted, and nobody had a tour. It was just part of our happy environment, you know.
A happy environment.
Going back to school again and your memories of school, I think you've shared with us before your early interest in poetry and the encouragement you got with your writing.
That came
Can
in
you tell us about that.
That came in high school when we had a principal named Frank Kaler, who looked like Thomas Wolfe, you know, white shirt, black pants with chalk dust on it, you know, big presence. And I was always kind of enamored of him, and I would send him my poems by a colleague because I was too shy to take them to him myself. And he read them, you know, he never commented until in a class. He taught a class of literature, and in the class that one day we were reading poetry, and some boy in the class, my name came up, and some boy in the class said, "Nobody can understand what she writes." And Mr. Kaler said, "Oh, on the contrary, she writes about the most serious things in the easiest language." It's not his exact words, but he stood up for me. Oh man, it was like, whoa, he had me.
There you go.
And when I moved to Atlanta, we both went to the Episcopal Church. He had a British wife who taught English at school. And years later, when I moved to Atlanta, we found each other at the Episcopal Church we were attending. And then they moved back to England, and when he would come home to visit his son who still lived there, he and I would go out to dinner. You believe that? And many times. And the last night that he was not going to come back, we sat in my car in the dark in front of his son's house, and he said, "I don't know how I'm going to get along without you, but I've gotten along without you all these years." And he got out of the car. He never touched me. We never had anything like that. But imagine having that kind of an intense relationship with a man that you admired as a teenager.
Yes.
You know?
Now,
when you're mentioning the Episcopal Church, is that the church downtown that has the chapel that's named after your family?
Oh, no, that's the Methodist
window?
Church.
Tell us about the chapel at the Methodist Church.
Well, that was the church of my family, and Judge Burgess and his wife, and my cousins went to that church, and my father made sure that I and Jimmy and my brother George went to church, whether or not we needed it or not, and he went to church one time, and that was Easter sunrise service at the Ford. That was it, but he made us go. And so there's a window dedicated to my aunt, the Baker, to us, it's the Baker Burgess family, and I'm not sure it's been moved, I'm not sure what room it's in, but I have a friend who goes to the Methodist Church, and she and I found it together, you know, and we took a picture.
Now, you mentioned to us that you lost your father when you were very young, and then your father remarried, and how did that impact your life and what was going on in Fernandina?
I don't know the dates of when he remarried, but the summer that my mother left, and she left, gone, not a word, and my father sent Jim and I, she took George with her at that time, and my father sent Jim and I to relatives in Jacksonville, the McElwains, and Mr. McElwain was some big deal at the Roosevelt Hotel, I mean, uniform and everything, and Jim and I lived with the McElwains all summer, and then, at the end of the summer, my father came And he had, he said, he brought in this beautiful young blind woman. He said, "This is your new mother." And I can't remember how I felt or what we said, but we all called to the living room, and that was my stepmother who raised me. And we had a difficult relationship right at first because, you know, she was younger than him, and I was a prized daughter because I was the only girl.
How old were you?
How old was I? How old was I?
You were eight. You were six when your mother left.
Yeah, I was about, I was about seven or eight, I guess. And so anyway, we were taken care of by the McElwains all summer, and then my father came with Lucille Clendon and his new wife, and then...
And you moved into the beach house?
Then he built the beach house. See, I'm not clear of that because I was just a kid. But,
yeah.
But I know that Lucille was in the beach house as the mom. And she took good care of us. We had a breakfast room. She made breakfast every morning before we went to school. And there was in the heater room, there was a ironing equipment like you would see at a dry cleaners, because my father was very picky about his clothes, and he had a maid that ironed his shirts on that. So, anyways, my father was something else, I tell you.
How long were they married before your father suddenly died?
Okay, I was 13 when my father died, so let's see, dates. Escaping me, but
no, the age is fine. Huh? We can work that out later.
I was 13, and after he died, my mother was devastated, absolutely devastated. What she did was she sent, and this was not a good thing, it was in the summer before school started, she sent my brother Jimmy and me off to boarding schools. She sent him to Montverde School in Montverde, Florida. She sent me to junior college. And in Georgia, I'm trying to think of the name of it. See, this is what escapes me. But anyway, she put me on a bus with my stuff, on a Greyhound bus, and it let me off in at the school. And I took my stuff and went up and got myself. From that point on, I knew that I had to take care of Nola. Nobody else was going to do it. You know, it was a revelation.
So how long were you away from Fernandina before she gathered you up again?
The whole school year. And she never came the whole time. And she, what she did was she tried to take over my father's route with Skinner Tire and Rubber Company. They were in Akron, Ohio. And she thought she could do that because they knew her really well. And I think that was her reason for sending us away, so that she could be free to do what she wanted. But when I came home, when we came home, one of the sad things that happened is Jimmy ran away from Montverde School with a friend of his, and the police picked them up in Jacksonville, and Lucille had to go and get them. So we didn't do very well with boarding school, but I stayed, and I had a pretty good year. But when I came home, my stepmother had got a whole new different band of friends, and there was a lot of partying and a lot of drinking. And in one of my books, I've written about something that happened at that time, which I'm not sure I want to talk about that right now, but it was
difficult.
A man came into my bedroom when everybody was gone, and I wrote about it in my book.
You don't have to talk about it.
But no doors were ever unlocked. I mean, it was a safe time. But that guy wandered into the house, wandered upstairs, and I came out of my bedroom, and I saw him, and I wasn't frightened. I said, "Do you know where my mother is? My mother's not here right now." And he said, "No, I don't." He went downstairs. So I thought, okay, everything good. I went back to bed, and then he was back in my bedroom, and that was another story.
So your stepmother started living up a living life.
That she did, and she.
And where were you in your schooling, and when did you go to college?
Okay, let's see. I was in.
Did you not live with a friend to finish high school here?
I did, but see, my father, one of his boarders in the house, beach house, was Bill Veach, William A. Veach, who was a. Came from Washington State to calibrate the machines at Rainier. He was a fabulous electrical engineer. Well, he rented the downstairs Wright apartment, and he fell in love with Lucille, absolutely did. And as soon as my father died, he was there, you know, courting her. And she wasn't that ready for that, but finally, she agreed to marry him. I won't go into a lot of things that happened in the interim that were not good, because they married, and she was supposed to go to Venezuela, where he was an electrical engineer at that time for Westinghouse in the Mini Grande oil fields and whatnot, and she didn't go. And then he came back to get her, and that was not a whole... something I really want to talk about, but the fact is that she did go, and at that time, my best friend was Joanne Ritchie, and Mr. Ritchie worked at Container Corporation, I believe, and they moved into the apartment across the street, and Jimmy moved in with one of his best friend's family. He was a sophomore, I was a senior. So my senior year, I had there with the Ritchies, and then when I graduated in 1947, my stepmother had arranged for Jimmy and me to fly to Venezuela for a visit, you know, the summer. Well, we got on a plane and we went to Venezuela, and Jim worked for Bill a bit, and then when it came time to go home, I wouldn't go. I stayed a year. I was so in love with Spanish language, and I was writing poems at that time, and I have them in my archives, all the poems I wrote, the short stories I wrote. That's part of what I'm collected this week. I've got full of it. But anyway, I just
so
was,
you were there
I thought
for
I would
two
go to
years.
The University of Caracas, you know,
mm-hmm.
And I thought that after a year, my stepmother was saying, "What are you going to do with your life?" Mm-hmm. You know, I knew it was time to go back to Fernandina. So that summer, that was 40. Well, I was there. I was that summer at the end of that summer where I went right after high school. I went back to Fernandina, and I stayed with various friends and all, because I didn't really have a home. And my best friend was Elise Holmes, and her mother was a nurse, Julie Holmes, at the Rainier, was the nurse there. And so I moved in with her that whole summer. And then how I met Andre was, they were having a big party at her house, Elise's house, and I was in a car with a friend that pulled up, and I heard it all going on, and then somebody came down and said, Andre passed out on the wheel of the car, we have to get him up. He got drunk. You know, he was not used to alcohol the way young men were when he came here, you know what I'm saying?
Let's back up a little bit because we want to keep the transition. So you came back, you really did not have a home.
No.
And then you went to college?
Well, that was at the end of that summer that I came back. And Andre and I were dating very heavily.
You met Andre before you went to college.
Yes,
okay.
That summer I came back, and we dated that entire summer. And then I went, my aunt, Murdy Burgess got me ready to go to college, to FSU. So I went to FSU, and I was there that first year. And then Andre kept coming. Every few weekends, he would come and stay at a motel. And so on one of his last visits. It was nighttime when we walked out in the archery courts, and he got down on his knees and he said, "I want you to marry me. I want you to marry me now. I want you to quit school and come home, or we're done." And he had the ring in his pocket. He knew I wasn't going to say no. Best thing I ever did in this life was marry.
No, like, you've got to give us a little backstory. Andre's very special story and how he ended up on Amelia Island.
How he ended up here. Okay, well, his mother, his family is from Alicante, Spain. Spanish name, you know. He was not born in Spain. His mother was going to France,
Marseille,
to join her sister, and blah blah. Her mother was there, and she got as far as. See, this is where I'm losing my train. She met this guy while she was traveling, and he was in. Gosh, I wish I had my papers with the name. They never married. She moved in with this fella. They never married. They had two beautiful daughters. And then they had Andre, and Andre, the father was Muslim, the mother was Roman Catholic, and the guy's family, they were wealthy, but they rejected him totally. And he after the kids were born and whatnot, he shot himself in the bed, and my sister-in-law Sylvia found him. Okay, so Andre was just a baby, just born. He never knew his father. And so they went on to Marseille, where he was raised.
Didn't Andre get here to Amelia Island because his sister was a war bride from World War II and married a band member?
Yes, exactly. Vincent Ferreira was her husband, and he's the renowned Ferreira family here. And Vincent was in the army. He played the saxophone. He was in the army band. They went to Marseille to do a gig, and Mimi and a friend went to the concert. And after that, they got acquainted. She started dating him, and then when he had to leave, he said to her, "I don't think I can leave you here." I said, "How did he ask you to marry him?" And he said, "He didn't. He just said, I don't think I can leave you here." So they got married at the town hall, and he went on to Fernandina, and she had her first child, Vincent, there. And then the war brides went home on a ship together, whatever, and she came to Fernandina, and that's where her life started. She didn't have a very easy time of it here because her English was not stellar, and there were no French people here, and she had a very difficult time at first.
And that's when she invited Andre to come visit her?
So she asked Vincent if he would vouch for her brother to come to the U.S. Well, Andre said later, "All I ever wanted was to go to the U.S. He said, "I jumped on a boat, a Russian tanker, and came into Ellis Island, went through Ellis Island, and he was happy as a lark, and got on
the trip." How old was he when he came to the United States?
He was 19 when we married. I was 18, so he must have been about 15 or so, I would say. Mm-hmm. The train pulled up at the dock in Fernandina, and I think he must have thought. I many times said, "What did you think? Did you think, was this it?" After being a huge seaport of
Marseille.
But he made a life here, and when I met him, he was working freelance, doing, working for carpenters and whatnot. And he was a close friend of my brother Jim's, and And Jim had said, before I came home from South America, Jim told him, I want you to meet my sister. She's coming home from South America. And so we met, were introduced, and that was it.
And you were married here in Fernandina?
I was married here in Fernandina.
What church?
I was married in St. Peter's Episcopal.
What year? What date?
The date was, January, February 18th, 1950. And the Reverend Frederick Golden House married us. And I got a lot of traffic from the community because Andre was Catholic. But it didn't matter to him, and he married me in my church, you know. So then my friend Iris.
Tell me about your wedding.
Oh, my wedding. Okay, my Aunt Murdy was such a mother to me. She did my wedding. She arranged everything. We had the reception at her house. She took all my gifts in.
How many people did you invite?
I didn't invite anybody, but the church was full.
There you go.
And her daughter, her oldest daughter.
Your Aunt Gertie's oldest daughter.
Yeah, not Martha, not Jeannie, but Barbara, who married Dr. Dickens. She was my first cousin. My aunt asked Barbara to take me to Jacksonville to find something I wanted to wear for the wedding. Well, I was so anti-establishment and so anti-wedding, and I would not have a white dress. And I chose a navy blue suit, navy blue suede high heels, and a navy blue hat with a big flower here. That was what I was married in.
Well, we have seen the pictures, and you were a beautiful bride.
I wouldn't choose China or silver or anything. I like Duncan Hines pottery, and that's what I wanted. And you know that my aunt, God bless her angel heart, and this is in my book, A Magical Life, bought sterling piece by piece, had it engraved with a P, and put it all in a big chest and gave it to me. She said,
"That was a wedding gift."
As after I was married, she just said, "You know, no niece of mine is not going to have silver."
There you go.
Where did you and Andre live after you were married?
Where
did you live on the island?
We moved into the beach house in the apartment on the right side that Bill Veach and Lucille were running at that time.
So your stepmother was living upstairs when you and Andre were in an apartment?
Yes. So we lived there until he was the first married man drafted during the Korean War. And I remember there was a picture taken with the mayor shaking his hand on the steps of the post office because he was the first married man. And listen, he was not even an American citizen yet. He was still a French citizen. But he went off to basic training, and I went to Jacksonville and stayed with his sister Mimi, who was then living in Jacksonville. And she took me in, and then he went off to, he did not go, there were two men that were not sent to Korea in his group, and he was one of them. They sent him to Germany as an interpreter, and he spent that whole term of his army duty in Germany.
Did he speak German as well?
No, but his CO was interested in French, or I don't know. Somehow he got there, and his CO loved him, gave him his CO's private car to ride him around in, and allowed him to go to France with one of his friends. He had a really close friend. And
how long after you were married was he sent away from you?
Let me think now. It was must have been only about a year or so, because I remember that his sister had moved to Jacksonville at that time, and she moved while we were in the apartment. So I'm not really
not very long. And how long was Andre overseas?
Two years. And when he came back to the States, I was working at a container corporation as secretary to the timber department manager, who at that time was Seaman Hudson. And I had the entire department to take care of. And when he came home, I would have had to quit because they don't allow, at that time, they didn't allow members of the same family to work there.
Oh.
And so I was asked, are you going to quit? Or is, and I said, he's not coming back here. He's going to college. He got the GI Bill.
Mm-hmm. Where did he go to school?
University of Florida. And he got a bachelor's of civil engineering in 4.5 years.
And where did you live during that time?
At the beach in an apartment. I kept the car, and that was a safe time when they could. There were a bunch of guys from Fernandina, and they all lived in a rented house together, and they hitchhiked their way home, if you believe that, but it was safe. That's what he did. And so he would come home when he could. And
needless to say, you lived here during World War II.
Yes.
What happened during World War II that you remember? Were you part of the people who watched at the beach?
No, my mother was an airplane spotter. Lucille, my stepmother, was an airplane spotter. And she also worked a little bit at one of the mills, because I remember she had long blonde hair and she had to wear a snood. You know what a snood was?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, she had to wear a snood. So I remember that we had black oil cloth at all the windows. It was black out, you know, after dark. And they had the horse patrol that monitored the beach. Policemen on horseback monitored the beach.
Because?
Because there were ships out there being torpedoed.
Really?
Yes, there was. And
wasn't there also by Egan's Creek, didn't they have an Air Force presence?
They had servicemen here on the island. And I remember because there was a big controversy about the high school girls dating the servicemen. And President Roosevelt's, what was it, his workforce, he during the war, there was one of those there.
Civil engineering?
I wish I could remember more clearly the name of it, because it was very famous during the war that he did this to give men work, mm-hmm. that were in the military, you know, and they took care of community problems.
Civil engineering.
Well, I think civil engineering. Maybe I'll come up with it. Sometimes when I'm not looking for something,
exactly,
it pops up. So.
What about the our airport?
About what?
What about our airport here on the island during the war?
I don't have any memory of that whatsoever. I couldn't tell you about that.
Okay.
One thing, this is kind of an aside, but the history of the paper mills on the island has been very important to the economy. So
yes.
Growing up, Rainier, when you were a small girl, Rainier was...
Always. Both mills were operating. And at that time, they had a really bad odor and people were just hated it, but under control now, I guess. But
and it employed a significant number of people
in
the community?
Yes, it did. And it was either, let's see, Container Corporation is now something else, but Rainier has always been Rainier, and employed a lot of men that weren't in the military.
How many women actually worked for Rainier in anything other than secretarial?
That I don't know, but I know that my mother did a stint there helping out. I don't know what she did, but I know she went to work at Rainier in the absence of some of the male employees. And then they had a huge tower at Main Beach that was the spotters, the airplane spotters, and she worked there as well.
What was your sense of the economy during the war in the town?
Only in terms of restrictions. You know, we had no sugar, no shoes, leather, blah, blah. I remember I had to, butter, no butter. We had those big globs of white what do you call it? And I had to mash the yellow to make it look like, but I remember doing that. And I remember how difficult it was to get shoes. But other than that the war was very far away from us, you know. We had the newsreels, we had the D-mail that came. My brother George had joined the Navy to avoid being drafted, and he was sent to the Pacific. And there's this wonderful story about him. His ship was torpedoed, and he got a commendation from his commanding officer for helping with the dead and the wounded and getting the ship back to harbor. I even got the name of the ship and everything in my archives.
Now we need you. You started, you and Andre started your magical life traveling and living in different places around the world. And then we need to circle back to Fernandina.
Okay, well, after he came back from the service, he was working and got his degree and everything. He went to work for the Army Corps of Engineers in Jacksonville, and my mother's sister, my favorite aunt, Lillian, was a secretary to the then, in Tallahassee, to the then, I can't think of his name, but anyway, she asked him to help Andre get a job with the government because he wanted it, and he did. I'll think of his name in a minute. He was the Attorney General, Florida Attorney General, and she was a secretary to him. She was real smart, and not like my mother.
So that ended up in a job for Andre?
With the Corps of Engineers in Jacksonville. And while working at the Corps of we bought a house in Jacksonville eventually. And then I had my two little boys. And then Andre went to work. He was appointed to work on the new Panama Canal feasibility study. And the thing is, anybody who was working on, who got to work on that, had to agree to leave Jacksonville and at the end of it if it didn't go to construction. And the choices were Washington or Atlanta. And my husband, being a European and being brought up the way he was, it's a miracle that he listened to what I wanted and always acquiesced if he thought it was a good idea. And I said, I'm not going to Washington. So we went to Atlanta in 1970, I guess it was.
And so from Atlanta, when did you go into Paris and Brussels?
Okay, in Atlanta, he worked at the airport. And he got really, really tired of being with the Corps of Engineers. He got burnout. He was very ambitious. He got burnt out with things and wanted to move on. So he went with the FAA. He went to work one day, and an FAA friend he knew was in the elevator. And Andre was saying how tired he was with the work he was doing. And the guy said, why don't you ever consider the FAA? Well, he did, and he got a job with the FAA. And so what happened after that was that in Atlanta, when that plane in Lockerbie, Scotland went down, you know, and the then president appointed a civil service guy to be in every major city of Europe for airline security. And Andre applied for the job in Paris, and he got it. So we got to go to Paris, 1990 to 1994. And he had responsibility for France, Belgium, the Netherlands, and he was attached to the American Embassy. And I had just gotten a grant in Atlanta, and I had a book to write, but I went to work for him in his office. When he went to the embassy, there was no office for the, it was called the CASLO, Civil Aviation, CA, Security Agent for the government, for airline security in foreign airports, a liaison job. He was a liaison. And there was no place for an office for him, so he had to get an office on the economy, and he had no secretary, so I worked for him for a year. I set up his office, and I did everything his secretary would do. And of course, I would not get paid because they don't pay you. But I was glad that I had the experience that I could do that for him. And then he got a good secretary. And then I went to work at the embassy part time, and I stayed as long as I could. I hated it. I hated it. All those combinations of safes and stuff. I wasn't good for that. And with the military peeking over your desk, you couldn't leave a paper anywhere.
So we need to move you from Paris to Brussels. What's
okay.
next?
Okay, so so he was 4 years in Paris, and then he wanted to stay. And they had already appointed another man, so he couldn't stay. We had to leave, and we went to Miami Beach, and he got where the same job was for South America, Central America, and the Caribbean for airports there, as liaison officer with the host governments. And so we were in Miami 3 years, and then his health started going down, and he was hospitalized. He had heart problem, but his doctor said he was well enough to go to Europe. He wanted to finish up in Europe, and he applied for Brussels as the liaison there, and he got it. And I knew he wasn't well enough, but the doctor said okay, so we went, and we were there what, 2 years? And then his health really took over, and we had to come home. And he had his retirement, but he didn't retire soon enough to even enjoy it, you know.
So when you had issues and concern about his health, then you wanted to come home.
Yes, I did. I didn't feel like he could go through another stint in Europe, because he had had that severe hospital thing with the heart, and
So you settled back in Fernandina, and you've stayed ever since.
Yeah, well, let's see what happened. We came back from Brussels, and we had loved Miami Beach so much. I mean, it was so wonderful that time, and we thought we would retire there because mm-hmm. we liked it so much. And guess what? We were there 2 weeks, and totally changed.
Wow.
It was not a good place to be. And Andre said, well, let's just drive north. We got in the car.
Okay.
And we went as far as St. Augustine. We lived for 2 years in St. Augustine. And during that time, all we did was go to Fernandina. Andre played golf. And I decided I wanted to be Catholic. I was in RCIA. And I had to go every week to RCIA at the Catholic Church there and stay overnight and come back. And finally we said, this is stupid. You know, why are we going home? We went home, we bought that house in Marsh Lakes.
So what was it like coming back after all your traveling and living in different places?
Well,
how did you find it different?
Did it feel like home again?
Well, that Marsh Lakes community is very upbeat, and it wasn't like coming home as I remember home being, you know. And
was not on the island.
No, and I was very engrossed in St. Michael's Church, and loved it. And then
what made St. Michael's special to you?
What made it special?
Yes,
the priest. When I started to be interested it was in St. Augustine. I went to the Episcopal Church service, and then I thought, this is not doing for me anymore. I walked across to the cathedral, and I was there for one mass, and it was all over. And I thought I would do RCIA there, and I started there, and I didn't like it. I didn't like the people, and I told Iris, my friend Iris, who's such a staunch Catholic, she said, oh, don't give up. Come to Fernandina, and I'll and talk to my priest. And so I did, and that was, I'll pull his name up in a minute, but he met me at the door with his dog, and I spent an hour with him, and it was all done. I just loved him, and I loved the associate priest there, who was a good friend of Andre's, and he would come and sit with Andre and have a lunch with Andre, and they were so, at that time, the people there were so supportive and caring. And
well, you're still a member of St. Michael's, are
yeah,
you not?
Oh, yeah. But it's very different. It's very changed. But
in what way has it changed?
They're more remote. And I'm not one really to get, and I was ultra involved with that priest and the assistant priest when I came into the church. And I did a lot of stuff. I was on a call to go to the hospitals and things, you know, or nursing homes and meet with the people who needed company. And I did a lot of stuff like that I no longer do. Well, I'm not really able to do any of that anymore.
Well, we kind of want to finish with your books. You have published an enormous number of books. All had a goal and a purpose and
there
a mission.
Are the Fernandina books I brought in here. What did I do with them?
Well, first of all, how many books have you published?
It's written down there. I don't even remember.
16 books.
Something like that.
16.
All of them poetry except three memoir. And the three books I did, and I got really going with publication in Atlanta because I joined a workshop with Walter Griffin, the poet's a poetry group, and it was publication oriented, and I started publishing like crazy, and then I did three books, and
You shared with us that there is an archive at the University of North Florida. Can you tell us a little bit about the archive?
Yeah. One of the members of my poetry group, became a good friend of mine, and she worked with them at the library, and the dean was a very good friend of hers. And so she took me over there, introduced me to the dean, and told the dean all about my work and all I had done, that she was interested that I get into the Northeast Writers archives. And the dean agreed. So I went home, I got all my stuff together, and I brought it over to the library. A friend of mine took it over, and they met us at the door and took all my stuff up. And so it's available there for anybody who, and it's all my,
well,
my archives.
I'm seeing on the list 19 books, and
yes,
four of them are memoirs, and
yes,
one is actually called A Magical Life, The Early Years Growing Up in Fernandina.
Yeah.
And the books are wonderful. Nola has a great talent for creating a sense of experience. Your love of poetry led you to start a poetry group affiliated with a bookstore on our island.
I just wrote a piece called Why Poetry? I'll give it to you. And I sent it to the Writer's Digest essay contest, and it tells you all about why poetry. Because I grew up a very introspective and bookish child, and I started writing poems because I don't know why. It's because I did. And I wrote poems and I wrote poems, and I left some on the rail at the Methodist Church for the minister to find at communion. And I wrote poetry because I just wrote poetry. I just, it kept coming.
And those of us that know you know your love of sharing it and encouraging people. Now, you started a poetry group affiliated with a bookstore on the island. Could you tell us just a little bit about that?
When Ron and I did our poetry play at the defunct Little Theater, sadly, I miss it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
He put on an extravaganza poetry play where four actors read my poetry, and there was a big screen with images and a clarinetist who played and blah blah. So after that, we started. After that was over, we just kind of, some of us just sat around reading poetry in the little theater, and then we decided we'd start that little group. And Marilyn Wesley and I were ahead. And then the owner of the little theater said, well, you know, she had a canteen next door. And she said, if y'all want to start meeting over there, you can, you know. So that's where we got the Poetry Canteen name from. And we started meeting there. And we met there as long as we could. And then because she sold the theater and all that, then we went to the library. We met in the community room at the library for a number of years. And then when Story and Song came, we got interested in doing it there. So then we moved Story and Song. And we can't meet right now, of course, but I'm keeping things alive with email.
Knowing that we're probably getting, with your chimes here, over an hour.
Oh,
and,
okay. You think
what,
you've got enough?
We don't want to wear you out. What's your favorite thing about Fernandina?
Well, it's home.
It's home.
It's home, and there's water. I have to be near water. I have to. Even in Europe, there was a big fountain near me. I had to have water. I'm not comfortable without it. And the ocean is my real mother. My
there
grandmother.
You go. The ocean is your
salt
happy
water
place.
In the
well,
veins.
We would like to thank you on behalf of the museum that this will be a wonderful archived recording of your very special memories of Fernandina, which eventually became Fernandina Beach. So thank you very much.
Lose the beach.
Lose the beach.
Lose the beach.
All right.
All right. This is the end of the recording of Nola Perez on October 27th, 2020, and we're very delighted to have had her with us. Thank you so much, Nola.
You're so welcome. It was a pleasure.